Peter B. Collins, News and Comment. It's Thursday, February 27, 2014. Our ongoing coverage of the global surveillance apparatus continues. And if you use Yahoo webcams, be sure to put your clothes on and smile real big. No.
And I don't feel safe anymore. Oh, what a mess. I wonder who's watching me now.
Who?
The IRS.
It's a three-letter agency, but probably not the IRS. Millions of people who use Yahoo chat and webcams have been subject to monitoring, not directly by the National Security Agency, but by our partner in England called GCHQ. And I'll remind you that GCHQ doesn't operate under the same rules as the NSA. There's no Bill of Rights in England. There's no Fourth Amendment protecting you from illegal search or seizure. And there is no requirement that the British surveillance operations separate what are called U.S. persons out of the mix. They have none of those restrictions. And so what we learn from The Guardian, courtesy of Ed Snowden's revelations from his snooping in secret NSA files, is that a program called Optic Nerve. That's a clever name for it, isn't it? You'd never guess that that's monitoring webcams, is it? Would you? They collected still images from Yahoo webcam chats in bulk and saved them to agency databases, regardless of whether individual users were an intelligence target or not. That means millions of innocent people were surveilled through this process. In a six-month period in 2008 alone, GCHQ, in reports, acknowledges monitoring at least 1.8 million Yahoo user accounts globally. And we know that at least 7% of the images they captured involved nudity or sexual expression. So this is a violation of the deepest forms of privacy. And the article in The Guardian points out GCHQ doesn't have the technical means to make sure that no images of UK or US citizens are collected and stored by the system. This takes us back to our NSA whistleblowers, Bill Binney, Russell Tice, Thomas Drake, and the conflict in that agency over the use of the Thin Thread program, which only cost a few million dollars, was created in-house, and expressly protected the Fourth Amendment rights of Americans. No warrant, no looky under Thin Thread. But the Trailblazer program, which provided a feeding frenzy for corporate friends of the NSA, that was advanced, never deployed. Reportedly $6 billion squandered on that program. So this Optic Nerve program doesn't actually capture the entire live video session. It basically collects an image every 5 minutes from the user's feeds. Now, partly this was to comply with basic standards of human privacy rights, but it was a practical issue too, because it was an attempt to avoid overloading the servers at GCHQ. The documents describe the users as unselected. Unselected? That means it's just random. It's dragnet surveillance. Now, part of this apparently was to help them develop facial recognition techniques and software. And by collecting all these images, well, they had a lot of raw material to work from. But as the article notes, when you link Optic Nerve with the NSA's X Keyscore search tool, then they could find an individual's face and see if he or she showed up in a chat where presumably terrorist activities were being discussed. And so what we have here is an end run on our constitutional rights. The NSA tells us, with a straight face or a straight enough face, that they carefully safeguard the constitutional rights of Americans, well, American persons, which includes citizens and legal residents. But they use the five I's, that's spelled E-Y-E-S, which is the U.S., Canada, Britain, Australia, and New Zealand. They freely share this information so that our partners pick up data that the NSA is legally prohibited from collecting. And we heard recently, in the latest from Glenn Greenwald, based on the Ed Snowden tranche of information, that one of the ways that they marginalize people is by setting so-called honey traps, using sex to compromise an individual and be able to control them. As I pointed out, an average of 7%, but up to 11% of the Yahoo webcam imagery describes what, or is described as containing undesirable nudity. Now, maybe this is unattractive people who take their clothes off, but I think more likely it is information that they weren't trying to collect. And of course, they had to remind the people who review this information that you might want to look the other way because you're about to see people's private parts or maybe even sexual acts, and a reminder that they're not allowed to disseminate the offensive material. So that makes a lot of the people at GCHQ who review this info porn junkies, whether it's intentional, voluntary, or otherwise. Meanwhile, on these shores, it won't be long before Keith Alexander exits his job as head of the NSA and the Cyber Command. And he made a trip to Capitol Hill, which may have been his last testimony before the Senate Armed Services Committee. And this is where you kind of get whiplash, because Keith Alexander suggested that the NSA can probably live with sharp restrictions on its collection of our telephone metadata, and that they could live with restrictions that allow them only to get that data on targeted individuals with a warrant. And compare that with what's coming out of the White House. They not only don't want to end this program, we discussed the other day that they have talked about having the FBI manage the metadata collected by the NSA. And as we quoted our friend Shahid Buttar from the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, the FBI has an even worse record violating American civil liberties than the NSA does, and a longer running one. So now, get this. You know that Rand Paul, the senator from Kentucky and a presumed presidential candidate in 2016, has announced he's filed a class action lawsuit against the NSA to end the Dragnet metadata collection. Now the Obama administration is saying that 5 years of collecting and storing that information won't be enough. And they're blaming Rand Paul's lawsuit, saying, well, because of legal activities, we're going to have to keep this information indefinitely. Now, if you're a longtime listener here, you'll recall that I pointed out in 2012, in I believe it was February, there was a high-level meeting at the White House where it was determined that holding on to our data, information on innocent people, should be expanded to the 5-year limit. Before that, I believe it was 18 months. So, in 2012, we went from data collected on innocent people being held for 18 months, expanded to 5 years. Now we're going from 5 years to infinity. And the claim is it is to be able to respond to lawsuits from people like Rand Paul. And this is so insulting. They act as if we are just idiots who can't follow all this, won't be able to process the distinction between these various lawsuits, various issues. And the bottom line is that they are violating our constitutional rights on a daily basis. There's no way to paper over it. And meanwhile, Keith Alexander, and this responds to a comment that I quoted yesterday from a woman at the ACLU, who said, yeah, when a government agency gets its hand caught in the cookie jar, It doesn't remove the hand or close the cookie jar. It asks for milk to wash down the cookies. So while he was on Capitol Hill in this kind of nostalgic, almost farewell performance, Keith Alexander said, well, you know that big hack of Target's credit card accounts? He said he wants Congress to pass legislation that would expand the authority of the NSA and the Cyber Command at the Pentagon to protect private and business networks from online data theft and cyber attacks. Now, this is barreling forward in exactly the wrong direction. This is what I've been talking about in my fundamentals for over 2 years now, that any meaningful reform of NSA must confine its mission to the original statutory authority, which is it can only operate outside the United States. And so Alexander, applying mission creep principles here, is trying to get Congress to actually authorize domestic collection by the NSA. And of course, they've been doing it anyway. Why were they unable to prevent the Target hackers? So the duplicity here and the duality of this is stunning in so many respects. And of course, when they picked up El Chapo, the Mexican drug cartel leader from Sinaloa, they made sure to let us know that it was intercepted signals that led to the final determination of his location. And here's a funny line at the very end of the news story from The Guardian. Alexander would not address any aspect of the NSA's involvement in the bulk harvesting of data from Yahoo webcams by its British partner GCHQ, as revealed by The Guardian today. Webcam. That's a good question, Alexander said after the hearing, walking away from a reporter. Meanwhile, in a case, a domestic terrorism case that led to a conviction of a Brooklyn man, the government has had to notify an Albanian citizen named Agron Hasbadrami that it had used information from so-called warrantless surveillance programs in order to convict him. Now, he pled guilty. He's one of those people who was accused, and instead of standing for trial so that we might actually see the evidence and perhaps a frame-up by the FBI used against him, he took a guilty plea and was sentenced to 15 years in prison. But now, because last year in the Supreme Court case that was successful at the time in deflecting the advance of lawsuits against the NSA, the Solicitor General, Donald Verrilli, maintained that in every case the Justice Department would notify defense attorneys for suspects and accused and now convicted people who were being brought to justice on the basis of these illegal intercepts of communications. So the worm continues to turn. And while I will be glad to see Keith Alexander go, his perjuring boss, James Clapper, remains in place. And the guy who's coming over from the Pentagon to replace Keith Alexander, so far, we have no information to suggest that he would be any better. Here at the Peter B. Collins Show, I rely on the kindness of strangers and people who become friends by listening to this podcast on a regular basis. Ira Scott just renewed the annual subscription. Thanks, Ira. Jeffrey Gill, Kevin Beckley, and Gary Batterson are regular contributors who've signed up to monthly subscriptions, and I thank each and every one of you. I need more people to sign up because some people, for financial reasons, or maybe they don't like my opinions, have decided not to renew their subscriptions. As you know, I've had to invest in some additional equipment, and we're still working through some of the debugging of the new equipment here. So if you've been on the edge, I hope you will tip over and come to peterbcollins.com, Follow the link that says sign up right under my picture on the homepage, and you can choose $5, $10, $20 a month, whatever's comfortable for your budget. You can get a 24-hour pass for a dollar. You can make a straight donation of any amount to help our equipment fund. Or the best deal is the $50 annual subscription. And with new annual subscriptions for those in the continental U.S., I've got a copy of the rockin' John Dist CD called Red Flag and a bag of kick-ass Kona coffee to get you going in the morning. So I hope you'll sign up and do so today. The other way you can help us is by accepting the offer for a free one-month trial at audible.com. Just click on the banner ad on the homepage at peterbcollins.com and sign up for a 30-day trial. And when you do, you get your first audiobook download absolutely free. And if you cancel at Audible within 30 days, you don't have to pay them anything. And in any event, they will give me $15 just for referring you to their trial subscription. So get clicking, will you? And do what you can to help keep us going here at peterbcollins.com. Well, next week, Benjamin Netanyahu, the extreme, radical, right-wing prime minister of Israel, will be visiting the White House to kick off AIPAC week. And as I mentioned, and perhaps I suggested that this week is AIPAC week, it's actually next week, there'd be 14,000 members of AIPAC convening in Washington. They descend on Capitol Hill with a coordinated lobbying effort, and it's very effective. It is the, next to the bankers, the absolute most powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. Well, Obama has decided he's going to try again. If you remember a few years ago, just before Netanyahu visited, Obama tried to reset the peace talks. He used 1967 as a starting point. And Netanyahu aligned even with some Democrats to hammer Obama into submission. And that was the last time he personally put his neck on the line. Well, next Thursday, Monday, he'll meet with Netanyahu. And then on March 17th, he will meet with the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas. And so he is in cahoots with John Kerry, trying to put some energy behind the peace talks that are generally stalled. And in my opinion, Israel has no intention of allowing them to move forward in a meaningful way. As I've mentioned, the other agenda item for Israel and its proxies at AIPAC is to try to scuttle the talks with Iran by changing the terms and demanding that not only Iran shut down its nuclear program, but also that it disarm its missile program. And I think that that is unlikely to be a tenable position, which I think is exactly what Israel wants. And what they are working on is trying to put some meaningful terms on the table. But one of the negotiators for the Palestinians, a woman named Hanan Ashrawi, offered a bleak assessment to the New York Times of John Kerry's efforts to get peace talks going. And she said a framework that allows each side to voice reservations would be self-negating. It will be a non-document. Any document not based firmly on international law, she said, will become a box of chocolates. You can pick and choose what you want. So, while I am grateful to see President Obama putting some of his prestige, maybe sensing there's a legacy opportunity here, I don't think that he has a sincere partner in Israel. And I don't see this as a promising new initiative. Meanwhile, Israel, over the last couple of days, conducted bombing raids for the first time in 8 years inside the borders of Lebanon. Now, Israel knows that Lebanon's ally Syria is a little bogged down right now with its own civil war, unlikely to retaliate. But still, it's a risky escalation of unilateral Israeli military action in the region. And that links to a new study, a study called Trigger Happy, just released by Amnesty International, an 87-page report which details accusations against the Israeli Defense Forces and their wanton killing of Palestinians. According to UN data, 45 Palestinians were killed, and this is isolated to the West Bank. It doesn't include Gaza, all right? So 45 killed in the West Bank between 2011 and 2013, including 6 children. Amnesty said it had documented the deaths of 25 civilians during this period, all but three of whom died during 2013. Philip Luther, quoted as saying, "The report presents a body of evidence that shows a harrowing pattern of unlawful killings and unwarranted injuries of Palestinian civilians by Israeli forces in the West Bank. In some cases, there is evidence there that they were victims of willful killings, which would amount to war crimes." And during this same period, just one Israeli soldier was convicted of wrongfully causing the death of a Palestinian. We don't know this staff sergeant's name. He shot dead a man trying to enter Israel illegally in search of work. And for that killing, the soldier received a one-year prison sentence with 5 months suspended and was busted a rank but permitted to stay in the Israeli army. And I want to just refer you to the powerful book called Goliath by Max Blumenthal, which details the ongoing violence against Palestinians and against non-Jews inside Israel. It is racism, it is apartheid, and it's tragic. It really is. Well, the conflict over Ukraine continues to simmer, heat up a little bit, as today masked gunmen seized government buildings in the capital of the Crimea region of Ukraine. They barricaded themselves inside, raised the Russian flag, and this leads to possibilities that there could be a separatist rebellion that could lead to a protracted civil war. Meanwhile, the ousted president, he was elected by the people. There was a deal that was made overnight last Friday, brokered by foreign ministers from other countries, and Yanukovych agreed to early elections and to limits on his power. And he's kind of saying, over here, I am the legitimate president of Ukraine. He's asking Russia to protect him. And he is arguing that any movement of Ukrainian troops without his order would be unlawful. It'll be difficult for him, of course, to impose his will. But you can understand that, kind of like Mohamed Morsi in Egypt, who often yells out from behind the cage that they bring him to court in, that I am the legitimate president of Egypt. These calls are ignored, even when they're broadcast in the Western media. It's amazing. And as you know, I'm no fan of Yanukovych. But the U.S. is declaring that this coup, which of course, like Egypt, we don't call a coup, is somehow a good thing, and it somehow it advances democracy. And what's interesting here is we have talked about the neo-Nazis, the neo-fascist elements who are part of the opposition that now appears to be in control in Ukraine. There are people who openly display Nazi symbols, they're skinheads, they're different hardline fatherland groups of Ukraine. And one of them includes veterans of the Soviet war in Afghanistan. You remember that one back in the 1980s? We didn't learn a thing from it, but I remember it. And so Ukrainian veterans of that war drove an armored car onto the plaza in front of the parliament building in Crimea. And a commander of a unit of the Afghan veterans, called the Afghan 100, said that in the discussion, the veterans had weighed the significance of the armed takeover of the regional parliament in Crimea a few hours earlier. And they called it a declaration of war. So we go from those veterans of the Soviet war in Afghanistan to a look at the rogues gallery of characters running to succeed our puppet, Hamid Karzai, to run Afghanistan starting later this year. And this, of course, is against the backdrop of the U.S. threat to leave. But we know that Obama wants to leave at least 10,000 American troops there indefinitely and maintain bases where we can launch drone strikes into Pakistan from. Well, if you recall, when Karzai was reelected, I think it was 4 years ago, it was a fraudulent election. And the Obama team tried to promote the interests of his opponent, Abdullah Abdullah, and force a runoff. But Abdullah said, no, man, come on, I'm not going to win a runoff. And then it became the position of the Obama administration that the election in Afghanistan was consistent with democratic principles. That was the least untruthful statement that James Clapper could conjure, I guess. Well, take a look at this rogues gallery, all right? We have a candidate for president named Ashraf Ghani, the apparent front runner. And just a few years ago, he referred to one of the nation's most prominent warlords, General Rashid Dostum, calling him a known killer. Now, Ghani refers to General Dostum as his running mate. Dostum is his vice presidential candidate. And the New York Times points out today that of the 11 campaigns in the April 5th presidential election in Afghanistan, six of those 11 tickets include at least one candidate who is widely viewed as a warlord. One of the exceptions is a brother of Hamid Karzai, who he may bow out of the race, according to the latest speculation. But he is not described as a warlord. I don't know this Karzai very well. His name is Kayum, Q-A-Y-U-M. But and he owns restaurants in Baltimore here in the United States. At any rate, Kayum is expected to get out of the race. But one of the other Karzai brothers was a known CIA asset who was knee-deep in the opium trade. And I don't know if that runs all through the family or not, but it's a really, really grungy cast of characters lining up for election in Afghanistan this year. Well, I will have to tell you that my impression of the intelligence of Arizona Governor Jan Brewer went up a third of a notch yesterday. And that's not very high. It never will be very high. But she did veto the problematic Senate bill in Arizona, SB 1062, which would have allowed people who claimed deep religious faith to discriminate against almost anyone. And it's just bizarre that people claim today that you can argue that religious freedom allows you to discriminate against persons whom your religion says aren't good enough or are sinners or infidels, what have you. And it just turns the secular arguments of rights on its ear. And I find it irrational and incoherent, but it is trotted out in the corporate media as very sensible. Oh, yeah, our religious principles don't permit us to sell a wedding cake or to take pictures of a gay wedding. It is such a crock. And yet, it is given respect and reverence by, well, from far too many quarters. Two Democratic senators, Barbara Boxer of California, Sheldon Whitehouse of Rhode Island, are now raising issues related to the Keystone XL pipeline approval about the health impacts of refining tar sands crude. Now, I don't mind that this is linked to the Keystone XL. It is, of course, a battle line that has been drawn. But as I've mentioned over the last week or so, I think that environmentalists have bet too much on the Keystone issue. And as I've said, it is worth a certain amount of betting because it puts pressure on the White House, which has the sole authority to make the determination on the Keystone pipeline. But I'm glad to see the senators raising these issues because this crude oil that will flow through the Keystone XL pipeline at 1,600 pounds per square inch at an elevated temperature that could burst at any junction or any hole in the pipeline, it'll get to Port Arthur, Texas, where it's going to be refined. And Texas, of course, doesn't give a shit about the environmental impact of refineries. But the federal government should and can. And just as a side note, I recently made a trip across one bridge of San Francisco Bay to the East Bay community of Richmond, where Chevron has a huge refinery. And I knew that they brought in crude oil by tanker ship, because I see those on the bay. And I also knew that there's a rail line serving the Chevron refinery in Richmond. But when I was over there selling some scrap metal recently, I was stunned at the hundreds, if not thousands, of tanker cars that were lined up to get into the siding at the Chevron refinery. And while I don't know the origins of those tanker cars, there is reason to believe that tar sands crude is already being processed, even in a state like California with stronger environmental regulations. So that horse is well out of the barn, and it's going to be hard to get her back in. May I end with something a little brighter, a little upbeat? I happen to love salmon, fresh salmon from the Pacific. And we have good news that the Chinook salmon run in the Sacramento River system is very healthy this year. The estimates from the National Marine Fisheries Service, about 635,000 fall run Chinook have been counted in the Sacramento River system. That compares to a low point a few years back when it dropped to a precipitous level. Last year, it recovered to about 406,000. And the best year on recent record is 2002, when 770,000 fish were spawned in the Sacramento River and in its delta system. So the concern now is that it's a three-year cycle. And the spawning that may be limited because of the drought this year and that water temperatures aren't sufficient, river depths are not sufficient for the fish to get all the way to their spawning grounds, well, we won't know the exact impact for 3 years. Hey, thanks for listening to my news and comment, my ranting and raving. Wow, you made it all the way to the bitter end. Nice going.
Happy trails to you until we meet again. Happy trails to you. Keep smiling until